From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Protests are unfolding in Egypt's Tahrir Square again today. Several dozen opposition movements are organizing the demonstrations in a show of increasing dismay at the new government's hardline tactics. The rallies today follow a violent month in January, where anti-government demonstrations left scores dead and many more injured. The latest unrest and the brutal police response to it come at the two-year anniversary of Egypt's unique role in the Arab Spring. In February of 2011, after weeks of street protests, the country's longtime president, Hosni Mubarak, finally stepped down. But since Mubarak left, Egypt's experienced a rough transition to a new government. The president, Mohamed Morsi, and his political party, the Muslim Brotherhood, have taken on broad powers for themselves. Meanwhile, accounts of police brutality and even torture continue. The military warns of growing chaos, and many ordinary citizens are despondent. The headlines are disheartening to hear after the hopes for Egypt 2 years ago, and they're especially disturbing to those Granite Staters with ties to Egypt who worry about the safety of loved ones there and about the country's future. Today in The Exchange, a roundtable of Granite Staters from Egypt joins us, and let's hear from you. Do you have friends or family or colleagues in Egypt or the surrounding region? How do you feel about the increasing unrest and disorder there, and what are you hearing from your contacts in Egypt today? Give us a call, the exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. With me in studio, Nabil Magali, co-founder and chairman of the Arab American Forum in New Hampshire. Nabil was born in Cairo, came to the U.S. in 81. He lives in Manchester, where he's a social worker by profession. And Nabil, it's really nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Also with us, Gamil Azmi. He was born in Cairo, raised in Suez, Egypt. He came to the Granite State in 1969. He lives in Warner today, where he owns and operates a farm. And Gamil, welcome back and good to see you too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Also with us by phone, Baha El-Aid. He's an engineering consultant. He was born in Egypt, came to the U.S. in the 80s. He's lived in New Hampshire since 2002. And Baha, thank you also for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Well, and Nabil, I want to turn to you first, but hear from all of you. Who are the important people, Nabil, in your life in Egypt right now, and what are you hearing from them?
Basically, my nephew, my niece, cousins, friends, colleagues. Actually, everybody in Egypt is related to me in a way or another.
Yeah.
What I hear that people are disappointed, do not feel safe. Many of them are hopeless. However, I think it is not that bad. I am cautiously hopeful. I cannot say optimist. People are not; they don't feel safe walking in the streets in some areas. Not everywhere. And I think the issue is when the revolution took place 2 years ago, it was basically a spontaneous uprising. The youth went to the street calling for a change. There was no leadership to the revolution, and this is just a fact. After Mubarak stepped down, now what?
Yeah, and it's been almost 2 years. He stepped down February 11th,
yeah,
2011. So almost 2 years.
I remember that, yeah. People were hopeful in the military at that time. We have a very good, strong love relationship with our military. Of course, not anymore after last year's events. We trusted the military that they will lead a reasonable transition. Unfortunately, they did not.
What do you hear, Nabil, about day-to-day life? You said people don't feel safe. So your family, your friends, your colleagues, what are they just telling you about day-to-day existence, you know, getting to work if they have a job, getting food, you know,
some
just managing.
Residential areas are safe. People who live in residential areas, there's no issue there.
And we're talking Cairo
yeah,
for you, right?
Yeah. The problem is if you walk into Tahrir Square, if you demonstrate in front of the presidential palace, you can always take the sidewalk and people will not feel your presence. But the immediate impact is the prices are very high. Security is very fragile, if I can use even the word security at this time. Hope in the future, there is no hope at this time. The killing part here is that people don't feel as a part of Egypt as they used to.
I want to ask you too, Baha, and you, Gamil. Baha, you first. Who is in Egypt for you right now, and what sorts of stories are you hearing from them?
I am the youngest of six brothers and sisters. They are all back in Egypt there. And I am old. I'm not young, so they are a lot older than me. I got nephews and nieces who are either college or working in the 20s and teens. I got friends also. I got neighbors. I remember from the old days I was there. People generally, the people I know, I would classify them as the average middle class people. People are getting basically, I'm going to kind of mirror most of what Nabil mentioned. They're kind of impatient. They expected that they should have achieved a lot in the past 2 years where they didn't. They're concerned about stability. They want to make sure they hear about the economy. They hear about the cash reserve in the for the country dropping dramatically from about maybe $50 billion to about $13 billion now. There are talk that the cash reserve will only be adequate for 3 months. After that, I guess that will mean bankruptcy for the country. One of the problems that happened early, without repeating what Nabil mentioned, other things that, in my opinion, were crucial but didn't happen, that the media, I believe, did not play a very strong role from the beginning of the revolution. The day that Mubarak left power and the army took over, the media gave the impression to the people that the worst is over and it's kind of like heaven. They kind of hinted to the people, everybody come up and take your piece of the pie. They didn't give the people the indication that this is the beginning of the hard work now. And the country was basically need to be rebuilt. It's not in good shape, so that people relax and start asking for, you know, what they need to get. You remember Kennedy when he mentioned that ask not what the country can do for you, ask what you can do for the country. People kind of didn't really, the media did not bring the people all the issues that need to be fixed first. And everybody start rushing, everybody start asking for a piece. And that really had a great effect that I believe it's we're kind of seeing that till now.
Well, Baha, if I could ask you the same thing I asked Nabil, the day-to-day for your brothers and sisters and nephews and nieces and so forth, what's the day-to-day like for them, especially the employment situation? We hear that young people are increasingly frustrated because they just can't get jobs.
Yeah, I agree with you. There's a big number of people who can't find jobs. They are graduated from colleges and universities, and they feel they did their part. Now the government got to do their part and find jobs for them. My immediate family, they are fortunate they have jobs. I would assume they're good jobs. But there are other people there. There's a big number of people who can't find jobs, and things are getting expensive, like Nabil said. It's the prices that I see there are getting very much in some areas kind of about the same level of prices here in the U.S. Even some stuff in the U.S., I would say, it's more affordable and cheaper than Egypt.
Wow.
So I can't imagine myself how some people get along there. There are some people who are really suffering very, very bad. Day to day, as Nabil mentioned, within the city, I was able, when I went there last time during the Christmas vacation, to move around. People were warning me about some areas like, you know, where there's a very continuous demonstration like Tahrir Square and near the presidential palace. These areas, you can go there, but there's no guarantee. Things could be quiet and nice for a day or two, but suddenly you hear about people getting, someone can get a stray shot or,
So stay away from those areas, right, as Nabil said. And Gamil Azmi, I haven't forgotten about you. Just remind us, if you could please, who is important to you in your life in Egypt right now, nieces, nephews, friends, whatever, and what's the news you're hearing?
I have an aunt and an uncle from my dad's side. I live in Suez, and an uncle, excuse me, an aunt and cousins live in Ismailia, and few other cousins in Bor Fuad and Bor Said, those who are doing business with the Suez Canal. This is more or less, so it's the extended family is in a large portion. What I hear is really not, Suez, Ismailia and Bor Said area is really more or less isolated a little bit, not
yeah,
much.
That's what's interesting about your experience is you're not in Cairo, and I am wondering what's happening in the other cities.
Last time they have a few buses there when the revolution started. One of my cousin's children, two boys, went into, that's why I told you, I think before they got caught into some kind of, I'm not really sure what it is, and they ended, both of their knees were broken right there, and they ended going back home. They both in wheelchair, one doing better. But anyway, to give you a rough idea, Suez is really a very strange place, a high concentration of Brotherhood of Muslims and other groups. And in the same time, they have, I don't know if people know that or not, Shell Oil Company used to be there. My dad used to work for them, and now it's called Misr Petroleum. Of course, now it's owned by the government. It's a huge refinery, one of the biggest in the country. And that's in the last few weeks. It's really major things been happening there. I'm not really sure because that's maybe related to what's happening to other part of the world or not, but they have the military, usually have maybe 5,000-6,000 people around there. There's what we call Qaeda. It's like a camp type thing. And now, Monday, I was told by one of my cousin in Canada, he's my main contact. He's really, that's all he does, communicate with the family, and then he communicate with me and my brother in the United States.
And Gamil, I'm so sorry to do this to you. I'm going to cut you off just for a minute, and then I want to hear the end of the story for sure. And we'll start taking your calls after a short break, too. 1-800-892-6477.
Okay. It's The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Good morning. Card-carrying members of NHPR can take advantage of special benefits all over the state. Restaurants, museums, and theaters, lodgings, new businesses are signing up every week to offer discounts to their member card holders. Visit nhpr.org for all available discounts and more information about the NHPR member card. Support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from you, our members, and from the NHHEAF, or the NEAF Network, organizations hosting Destination College, a college planning convention for high school juniors and parents in March. Information at destinationcollege.org. And from Lake Sunapee Bank, providing banking services for every business size and need. Information online at lakesunbank.com.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the Egyptian Revolution 2 years later. Granite staters who have ties to Egypt talk about the continued unrest there. We invite you to join us with your questions or comments. If you have family, friends, or colleagues in Egypt, what are you hearing from them about the increasing unrest, about their hopes and concerns 2 years after Hosni Mubarak stepped down? The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. To NHPR. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. We have three Granite Staters with ties to Egypt with us today, and we'd love to get your questions and comments in. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Gamil Azmi, just before the break, I had to cut you off there, but you were talking about how your family in Suez is near a very large refinery there, which makes sense, Suez Canal, and that the military was guarding the refinery. Is that always been the case, or is this building up given just the increasing tensions around Egypt?
No, there's always been military present in around the refinery. It's always been there, well, maybe 10,000 people, 10,000 soldiers or so.
Wow, 10,000 soldiers for one refinery.
It's actually a Qaeda, is like a camp. It's always been there.
Still,
since.
Yeah.
Right. And but anyway, last Monday, of course, you know about the situation where nobody can get out of the house, and then the president, my understanding is he lifted up to the governors of these states, Ismaili, Bursaid, Burfuad, to make their own timing. And of course now, if instead from 9 o'clock, to make the peace between the people there, all the population, they ended doing it from 2 in the morning to 5, and which is really show you that usually people have to sleep anyway, so it was okay.
I'm sorry, I'm confused. Can you back up a little bit? I'm not really sure. What
there was
mean.
There was a curfew.
A curfew, okay.
And the curfew was actually by the president that nobody can be around the street from 9 o'clock until 7 in the morning or 6 in the morning. And of course, some people work at nighttime and some people have jobs, different fishermen and Suez Canal employees. So that's really caused lots of problems, especially in Port Said, Port Fouad. And the uprising because of the curfew, and people ended the police ended attacking the people ended taking over, surrounding the police station, especially in Port Said, and also in Ismailia, in some of them. And the problem now is when the government found out they cannot control it, the people defied to be out locked in. So he changed his mind and said the governor have to make their own decision.
Each governor will decide when the curfew is going to be.
Correct. So they ended doing it from 2 to 5 in Port Said, Port Fouad, and I think Ismailia was the same thing. The problem is now is actually you issue an order, and then, of course, it gets changed many, many, many times.
So how are you supposed to keep track of when you're supposed to be in,
correct.
When you're supposed
so
to be out?
Correct. So they have no respect, actually, for anything he say, the president he say, or any group. One thing surprised me is I want to mention something that happened last Monday, and I think I should let you know about that. The more troops was coming into Suez, were not really, I think I know why, but not tanks, just in lorries, which is like big trucks, carriers, and they think now they got about 30,000.
30,000 troops in Suez
In Suez alone.
Wow.
And Suez have a high population of Brotherhood of Muslim groups. And matter of fact, in Maxi Street, they actually opened up in the last 2 years 3 offices to sign up people. Rashawi is becoming a horrible thing. Bakshish is like what you have to pay to receive services.
So lots of corruption.
Is back again where it used to be when I was there, 1970s, 60s. Anyway...
go ahead, Camille. Yeah.
Anyway, my feeling is, and my cousins think they will be actually, which is really going to be shocking to everybody, including my friends in this meeting here, that the military going to start taking over because it's getting really situation all over, getting really bad. Most of my family members, which is really, I keep asking that, they really don't know much about happening in Cairo or Iskandaria. They know what they can see. They know what's the communication between Suez and Ismailia is very close because they travel easier there.
Well, it's hard to know what's going on, too, when there's so much rumor and innuendo, so much fear and so forth. And before I ask all of you guys another question, I do want to remind our listeners that you can join us with your questions and comments and personal observations about what's been happening in Egypt 2 years since the so-called revolution there, almost 2 years to the day since former President Hosni Mubarak stepped down. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us if you'd like to, exchange@nhpr.org. And boy, Nabil and Bahat, I do want to ask you about something that Camille raised. It's this idea of, you know, who's holding the power in Egypt? Is it the government of Mohamed Morsi? Is it the police? Is it the military, which has sort of a different relationship to the people than perhaps we have here in this country? Nabil, when was the last time you were in Egypt, and what impression did you have of sort of who was pulling the strings there?
I was in Egypt in November.
Okay, so very recently.
Very recently. And it is not only my observation. Everybody knows what is holding the power in Egypt is the Murshid of the Muslim Brothers. the guide of the Muslim Brothers.
With and the that's the party in power.
Precisely. Actually, the Muslim Brothers is not a party. The political arm of the Muslim Brothers is a party, but the Muslim Brothers is the Muslim Brothers. By the way, technically, the Muslim Brothers, as we speak now, is illegal. It's banned. It was dissolved in 1954. They have no legal stand. However, the Murshid was the Muslim Brothers, and the very close people to him are running the country.
Mohamed Morsi.
Running the country, actually directing Mohamed Morsi.
I see.
I agree with Baha that people are impatient. But I don't call it impatience, actually. It is disappointment. For instance, Morsi has been in power for the last 8 months. What did he offer? What did he do? What did he try to do? He came with the promise of the Renaissance Project. Then when he came, we were told there's no such Renaissance Project, guys. He succeeded into practically dividing Egypt, literally dividing the population of Egypt, not Christians and Muslims, the Muslim Brothers and everybody else. So right now Egypt is divided. Muslim Brothers and their allies. Their allies are mostly Islamists, the Salafists, which could be translated like the predecessors, the ultra-Orthodox religious Muslims, and the Jama'ah Islamiyah, which is more radical, actually. When the army took over in February 2011, they literally conspired with the Muslim Brothers. The Muslim Brothers were released from jail. The jails were attacked, and the Muslim Brothers were released by force. And it was a deal between the army and the Muslim Brothers. Right now, the country is run by the Muslim Brothers.
So what's the army's role, real quickly, Nabil?
The army's role is very critical, because when the army took over in February 2011, we expected our army, the army that we always knew will be our army.
It's a personal connection.
A personal connection. Our brothers, our sons. The Egyptian army never, ever fired at the people in the streets, except after the revolution. The SCAF, which is the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, was in charge. And for the first time, actually, armories from the army ran over people in Tahrir Square.
Yeah, huge disappointment.
Literally. They had their own benefit from this. And it is not a political benefit. The army literally owns 40% of the Egyptian economy. I'm not talking about arms. I'm talking about the army is making detergent, soap, sodas, all kind of things.
Well, and guarding the refinery, like Camille told us.
No, the refinery, I think, is almost a kind of sensitive military base or area. This has the frontier. So the army was looking for their own benefits. Now, the Muslim Brothers are in charge. What did they offer in 9 months, in 8 months? So people have the right, the justification of being impatient. What is next? The Muslim Brothers have been under pressure for 80 years. The expectation was when they be in power, at least they will not do the way they were repressed.
Yeah, they were repressed as an illegal party, illegal group for a long time.
Unfortunately, they're doing worse, literally worse. And now they do it in the name of God. And this is the worst part of it. In 8 months, they did not offer any change, not even in the Islamic sense. They did not even do anything related to Islam. Islam is not a part of the game. It is money.
Baha, I haven't forgotten about you, too. And this is really important conversation. You were in Egypt also recently. What impressions did you have about who was really in charge there?
This is a big question that, again, because of lack of information, and you only have to draw things and try to read between the lines and try to figure out what's happening there. The fact that if you have a government and that government doesn't achieve and doesn't meet the expectation of the people, and it is really when the people are kind of like torn after 30 or 40 years that public service was kind of deteriorating. So what they get now is a lot less than what they used to get 50 years ago. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the government is not delivering, is not helping the people. Other groups also are not helping. Since the government came, there was a lot of things happening every day. One day, the teacher demonstrating, they are asking for a lot of things. Next day, doctors are demonstrating, judges are demonstrating, lawyers. So that goes back to what I said, that it's a group effort to build a country. And in that group effort, everybody has to do his role. The government, of course, get the bigger share because they have the leadership. They got to demonstrate the leadership, which they haven't done yet. They haven't tackled the big problem that people are waiting to solve there. The army role there, it's a kind of, I would call it, I mean, from my perspective, would be the last hope. Because if you don't have a strong institution like the army, I would say probably the strongest institution in the country, if the government collapse or fail or doesn't deliver to the people there, who else is going to step in? It's going to get chaotic there because everybody's going to say, I am the right person to come in. I am the one who got the support of the people there. The army, it's going to become kind of logical that the army will become the, whatever it is, horrible or not, or that scenario would like to see, but the army will become the kind of the logical thing that they're going to come step in and try to shore things up and try to secure the institution, the country there.
But do you trust them? Do your family and friends in Egypt trust the army?
People try to make a big distinction during the past 2 years between the Supreme Council of the army, about 20 generals, and then about the army itself as an army. The army itself is from the people there, so people have no problem with the army itself. The Supreme Council of the army itself, which it got involved in the politics itself, people basically judge the council from the result of what happened in the last 2 years. And definitely people weren't happy with too many of the things that happened.
As Nabil said,
over the 20 years. Now, you got to pick and choose from the 20, you know, whom you like and who you can't. And most of them are still there now. Only the top two or three, I guess, they got retired.
Yeah, but hold on a second, if you could, please, and all of you. I want to also remind our listeners that you can join us with your questions and comments and perhaps personal experiences with what's been happening in Egypt in the last 2 years. We have a roundtable of Granite Staters from Egypt with us, and we're getting their thoughts and reflections. Also, important stories from what they're hearing from loved ones in Egypt. Let's hear from you now at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you, Mina is calling in from Chelmsford, Mass. And Mina, thanks for hanging on. Go ahead, you're on the air.
You're welcome. Thank you. Yeah, the reason I'm calling, really, this talk has been really great. And but the problem we're having that we analyze too much what happened and what's happening, but what really we're looking, who to blame for what's going on right now? That's the biggest question that I have. We have made the choice to elect this person and this government. I mean, by either going to the pool and saying yes to the constitution or saying yes, we elect him, or by even not going, because I know there's a lot of people that they have feared to go to the poll to vote. And there's other people that they said, do you think I'm really going to make any difference? They're going to say yes anyway, or they're going to elect him anyway.
So you're saying, in one sense, if people are unhappy, they chose this government either by not voting or by voting for it. Is that what you're saying, Mina?
Actually, I'm not saying they are happy. I'm just saying I'm not making... What I'm trying to figure out, why are we standing now and we're complaining and we're still standing and we're yelling and we're screaming, we're standing in the Tahrir and all these cities. And what we're trying to gain from that at this point, are we really trying to get him out? Because I don't see that happening.
So what's the goal?
What are we trying to do? We have made the choice already. It's way... I'm sad to say that
Yeah, Mina, and hang on if you could for a second. We're heading into a break, and I can see my two guests in the studio really want to jump in. I really appreciate the call. I think, Gamil, you first. You look like you want to jump in. And Nabil, I know you have a thought, too. So go ahead, Gamil.
And me, too.
Okay. Heading into a break, so maybe we'll go Gamil, and then after the break, you other guys. And Mina, thanks a lot for joining us. Go ahead, Gamil.
My feeling in this, that people taste a little bit of freedom, which they don't know for a long, long time.
Under Hosni Mubarak.
And before him, and before Saddam and Nasser. And when they found out that they can actually do what they did a couple of years ago, they got that taste, and that taste is like a lifeline. So to answer this gentleman here, when they found out, well, maybe there was a mistake. Maybe there was corruption of choosing whatever happening now.
So the vote wasn't completely
so
free,
some
clear.
Some people think there's a lots of groups in Egypt. People think it's only Brotherhood of Muslim and the rest. There is Greeks community. There is a Palestinian community. There is Armenians in Egypt. And I know that for a fact. So, and other groups involved.
Christian community
and actually Muslim community. People in general. So when they found out everything is not exactly what's going on, and they said, oh my God, well, maybe it will be better under Mubarak. It was not as bad as that. Rishawi used to be $50, your money, now it's $100. And it's getting worse. And they only see a few people who are actually gaining from this new revolution, and nothing really happening. So they figured, hey, we already did something wonderful. Maybe we can go in and change it again. It's okay. A mistake was made, and we're going to go out and correct it. And that's what's happening now. To go back again into in about the military, you know, the army gets free labor from all Egypt. It's worse. So when you get age 18, you turn in, and they take you away for 3 years. You work in the field. You work in the fish company. You work in the farms. You work in all stuff. Most of these young people, they're going in there because it's a must go to the military. So the army actually using that. That's why, like Nabil said, they control 40% of
the economy. Yeah.
I don't think so. They control 65% of the economy. I mean, I know 19...
I'm going to jump in there. I do apologize. And when we come back, I would like to get back to Mina's point about the elections. And we will take a short break. We'll be right back.
It's The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from Living Innovations, with fulfilling job opportunities for those interested in helping seniors and people with disabilities at home and in the community. Online at livinginnovations.com. And from TransCanada, generating and selling electricity, and a proud supporter of Northern Forest Center's work to advance thriving communities and healthy forests. Northernforest.org. This is NHPR.
Sustaining memberships are powerful. Here's why. Your contribution is deducted each month from an account of your choice for as long as you want. It's convenient for you, and it creates a stable foundation of support for your public radio service. Being able to count on your support means NHPR can do a better job of serving you. Sustaining members, transforming the future of public radio.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Monday in The Exchange, new proposals for expanded gambling in the Granite State. Email us your thoughts at nhpr.org before the program and join us Monday morning, live at 9. Today in The Exchange, Granite Staters with ties to Egypt weigh in on the recent unrest there, 2 years after the Egyptian revolution, almost 2 years to the day since Hosni Mubarak stepped down. We're finding out what they're hearing from family and friends in that country and their own hopes and fears for the future. We'd love to hear from you. Our number here in The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And gentlemen, just before the break, we were responding to a call from Mina. And Nabil Magali, you next. Mina was saying, hey, we had this election and people chose this government either by voting for it or by not showing up to vote. And I know you want to jump in there. And Baha, I haven't forgotten about you either.
Okay.
Okay.
To start, Morsi's election is under question. We keep saying first democratically elected president. That's not true. Last week, Al-Shatir with the second guy, the Muslim Brotherhood, told Morsi, and this was all over the news, we spent £800 million for you to be elected. £800 million. I'm not saying this is money given directly to the people. This is money spent on the campaign and the intimidation and all this stuff. The population of Egypt is 83 million. Theoretically, if 40 million are voting, this means each vote costs £20 million. So you don't tell me this is a transparent, legal, pure elections.
Are you saying it was fraudulent?
Fraud was included. And actually, the army with the Muslim Brothers decided that the higher commission on elections, its decisions are final, not to be disputed, has immunity no matter what. So all the objections, all the complaints went to the trash.
So no teams of lawyers like we'd see here swooping in to
absolutely
debate
this. You have names. It took 3 days to count and change the numbers. So we cannot tell that the elections were really pure. If you go to somebody, cannot find his daily bread, to tell him, I will give you 5 kilograms of bread or 5 kilograms of oil. Swear on the Quran that you'll elect me. The person will take the money and will swear and will elect. However, let us say, assumingly, it was good elections and he was elected.
Which you do not assume.
Which I don't, as many people don't assume that. We know that. A big part of it was people had a choice between General Ahmed Shafiq and the Muslim Brothers. Somebody who belongs to the military, who was Mubarak's last prime minister, and somebody else.
So not two great choices.
So it was two bad choices, absolutely. Assuming everything was hunky-dory. Now, where is his accountability? He was democratically elected, okay. Who is he accountable to?
You're talking about Morsi now.
Yeah. He's accountable to nobody.
Because he's grabbed general powers,
and
broad powers for
even
himself.
The legislative power he gave to the Shura Council, he appointed 80% of their member, 30% of the memberhood. So there's no accountability.
Baha, go ahead. And Mina, I really want to thank you for calling in. You've added a lot to our conversation. Go ahead, Baha.
Okay. I'm going to just add a few points. Nabil mentioned that the last phase of the election was between two people, and the initial phase there were about 12 people running there, and most of them are what formed the opposition that got united now by the performance of the government, bad performance. People, again, you know, you're getting into the election, and you got to understand how the game goes. And when you have 12 people running against each other, each one get a small piece of the pie, except the two people who went to the final round get a little bit larger piece. And people just miss the point that you gotta get two or three people to unite together to add up their votes. And that was a big error on the part of the people campaigning there who are making the opposition now and complain that the revolution got stolen and they didn't win. And they start blaming other things. It's like irregularities in the voting itself. Now, the voting previously, before the revolution, there was a lot of complaints and stories about fraud and inaccurate votes. And actually, Mubarak used to get 99.999% every time he's
little suspicious, Samba.
Run for election. Yeah, very much when it's 99.99. You know, there were observers who went to the voting. I'm not saying it was great, but, you know, things are not going to turn lovely the next day. They take time. I mean, you get the culture of the people. You get the poor person who doesn't understand, and he will just easily change his vote, you know, if you give him something. And that happened in every country, in every culture. These things will take time. It's not going to change today. It's not going to change next year. It's going to take time. There's a big difference between, you know, rural areas and urban areas there. That, of course, doesn't give the excuse for people to go and try to manipulate others. That's completely wrong.
Baha, if I could ask you a question, and I'm not sure if you other gentlemen want to jump in, but Baha, you said you had a lot of brothers, sisters, younger relatives in Egypt. Is there a generational split, Baha, in how Egyptians feel about what's happening? Do young people see it in different colors than older people? What's your impression there?
The younger people are bolder now because they feel they're the one behind removing Mubarak, who nobody could ever imagine, including myself, that he can be removed. So they are emboldened. They feel that they can change anything wrong. The older generation are more with, well, let's give it a chance. You know, it may work. We need stability.
The impatience of youth, that's maybe a universal theme. And I also wonder, Baha, and you guys in Studio 2 perhaps, what about the role of women? Is the status of women changed at all from the Mubarak regime to now?
I can try to say something, and
sure.
If you other two guests allow me, and you. You know, there are a lot of voices that are coming now, and these voices were there before, but they are heard now. They got their microphone, and they can come as more often as they wish. And these voices are the ones that mention things that kind of horrifies us about, you know, equality and freedom, and that goes to other sectors other than women and minorities. And there are other people who are not happy to hear that, too. So the situation that happened since Mubarak is that you got more voices that weren't heard before. I mean, they did not change. They are the same voices. But they weren't heard, and now they are heard. They have the media. They have some. They have the exposure, and that's what's alarming. And you need with that, you need the leadership that define to people the values and the right things. And with the weakness of the leadership and the appearance of these voices, that's what make people kind of a little bit nervous to hear that.
So those voices have always been there, but they've got a louder microphone now.
Right. I think that's a problem. You remember the issue when a black, Harvard professor was having a situation with a police officer in Boston.
Yes.
And Obama stepped in and invited both of them to the White House and helped defuse the situation. So leadership is very important. And leadership doesn't go only with the president. It goes with the neighborhoods, leadership in everywhere. And that leadership needs to take effect to make sure that, you know, everybody has the right to say whatever he say, but the leadership will also say, you know,
that's not acceptable.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, this is reminds me of a headline that I saw just this morning talking about those voices. Here's the headline from, this is from AFP, so Agence France-Presse, so it's a well-known news organization. Friday's planned protests come just days after clerics issued fatwas to justify killing opposition leaders. Radical cleric, I'm afraid I'm going to pronounce this wrong.
Shaban,
thank you. A professor at Sunni Islam's main seat of learning, Al-Zahar, gave the green light to kill opposition leaders, including, this is a name that would be familiar to a lot of our listeners, former UN nuclear watchdog Chief Mohammed El-Baradi and ex-presidential candidate Hamdin Shabahi during a talk show on a satellite channel. Another hardline cleric also called on Muslims to, quote, kill the thugs, criminals, and thieves who burn the country. Are these some of the voices that you're worrying about, Nabil, and that
this
perhaps Baha'i is
this
talking
is
about?
A major concern. The point is this. Since the Muslim Brotherhood took over, any Muslim cleric, any Muslim scholar can give a fatwa. Edict, a religious opinion.
And under Mubarak, this wouldn't have happened because it was a secular regime.
No, we have the grand, you know, mufti for the country. He's the official person who is authority who can give the opinions.
Uh-huh.
Now everybody is giving opinions.
That microphone that Baha
everybody
talked about.
Is everybody. If we go back to the status of women, okay. There is no change except the women took a big part of the revolution.
I remember a lot of young women
Young women and children, actually. What's new now is sexual harassment of women demonstrating against Morsi, basically to deter them from demonstrations. And this is not a part of our culture. I mean, you can hear an incident here and there, but to have a systematic sexual harassment of women in public for political reasons, this is political corruption. It's actually an ethical corruption.
If I could just ask the three of you one more question before we close out, and this is to you, Gamil. So much turmoil in the last 2 years, as we've talked about. Again, getting back to your relatives, friends in several cities, as you mentioned before, Suez and others, I wonder how it's affecting people's mental and physical health, Gamil. You know, day after day, uncertainty, high prices, unemployment, security situation sketchy. How are people's mental health doing?
I don't think in Suez, Ismailia, or Bursa, either Bursa, it's really economically is hurt as much as the rest of the country. The problem now is actually protection for the
security.
So, like when the situation when the uprising lately happened, they actually took over some police stations and took all their women. There is women in Egypt. I'm shocked. When I was there in 69, no such thing called you can buy a gun. Excuse me? I never heard of it.
So average now, people didn't own weapons?
No. Nobody, period, owned women. Only the police have it or the military.
Right.
Now, actually, there are lots of weapon is actually in the hand of some of my relatives, which is very shocking to me. I say, oh, are you crazy, you guys? What are you doing?
But people are arming themselves. They feel insecure.
Right. And they actually, some of these women coming from Libya, some of these women coming from Syria, and actually some of the women, instead of going to Palestine, they're coming actually through a tunnel to Egypt. And that's a true fact. So there are lots of them actually for sale up there in Suez, Ismailia. And matter of fact, I know that for a fact, that some of my members of my family and their friends and other people actually having weapon and ammunition in those areas. And if so, that means other people actually having weapon. And my prediction is what's going to happen is it's going to be a bloody situation very soon. If the military, which I was told they're moving in the last 4 or 5 days into this area, under the assumption is for protection of some of the army buildings and facility, they're not really. The feeling is they actually something going to happen. Nobody knows where it is, and let's see, prepare ourselves. And that's, as far as I know, happening in areas of Suez and Ismailia.
So real fears, Bursaid, Bursaid
is yes. Bursaid, Bursaid is well known for hundreds of years that they are really a different part of Egypt. If you remember, they stood up against, they rise up against a different group. They even have songs and folk song about them during the English occupation and so on, right?
Baha, your family, how are they feeling about the future and how's their general state of health? I mean, it's incredibly stressful to go through all this uncertainty day after day after day.
You summed it up right. It's they are very stressful. They don't they continuous 24-hour stream of news that are mostly depressing and uncertain, and the a lot of unknowns. I mean, Nabil mentioned a few things, but the problem is that there is a lot of unknowns, and you have to start kind of making theories about based on what's happening there. And you can take the theory as far as you want, you know, about who's responsible for this, who did that, who told who what.
A lot of rumors and misinformation.
And Egypt is country number one in the world in making rumors. It's a by far, I mean, I couldn't see any other place where people would make rumors and would tell you the rumor with the, you know, manner that it's really happened. I saw it with my eyes. I heard it with my ears. So people are very much stressful, and they're getting to a limit. I mean, they're getting to a limit where they can't really take any more.
Yeah.
So hopefully there will be a bright light in the near future.
Well, we're all hoping. And Nabil, I want to close with a different question for you, mm-hmm. And that is, what role would you like the U.S. to play, if any, in these troubled times in Egypt, or should the U.S. just stay out and mind its own business?
We cannot mind our own business. As the U.S., we have interests, we have security issues all over the world. So to mind our own business is difficult. I think we need to keep a good balance, a delicate balance between our principles and our interests.
And when you say we now, you're talking U.S.
The U.S., yes. Yes, we have interests. Some of our allies are the worst in the world. Saudi Arabia is one of them, and others. Mubarak was, Sadat was. All of these guys were. We need to keep a delicate balance between our principles and our interests. If we see that Morsi is crossing the red line when it comes to human rights, when it comes to his commitment to his people, we need to stop him. I'm not suggesting that we stop him by war. We stop him by not sending F-16 like we did last week.
F-16s to Egypt just last
2 weeks ago. Two weeks ago. It's a part of a deal. So we need to decide where is the red line. Yes, we cannot confront every government, but where are our principles?
Well, gentlemen, I'm going to close it out there. And all of you, please give my very best to your family and friends in Egypt. I know it's really, really hard. Nabil, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Nabil Magali, co-founder and chairman of the Arab American Forum in New Hampshire. Bahat El-Aidi, great to have you. Thank you also for joining
us.
Thank
you very much for having us.
That's Bahat El-Aidi. Again, he's an engineering consultant. Moved to New Hampshire in 2002. Gamil Azmi, always good to talk to you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, man.
Gamil Azmi, born in Cairo, raised in Suez and other cities, as he told us. Today he lives in Warner, New Hampshire. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer this week is Mike Danielli. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteers, Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Our executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, we begin with the latest bills to expand gambling in New Hampshire. Proponents believe the cards may finally be right for their cause, given Governor Maggie Hassan's support for some type of increased gambling. Later, we'll hear highlights from President Obama's State of the Union address and get your reaction. And we'll end the week with the ins and outs of Governor Hassan's new budget. Email us at nhpr.org and join us all next week for The Exchange, every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.